open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
You're believing that there's a story here that if you chisel away at all the extraneous stuff, you'll wind up with something that does justice to this person who's entrusted his life to you.
Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Daniel Bergner tries to create a high level of intimacy between his characters and the reader, even though his books are mostly nonfiction.
Because I want you to be relating to the character with that intense closeness that you have when you're reading a character in a novel that you love. And if it's the painful scenes or the scenes of triumph, yeah, my job is to give you that sense of being inside the scene.
Daniel Bergner is the author of 5 books, including In the Land of Magic Soldiers and his latest, Sing for Your Life, about African-American opera singer Ryan Speedo Green. He's also a journalist who writes for the New York Times Magazine and other publications. Bergner talks this hour with Interlochen Public Radio music host and producer Kate Botello. She asked Bergner how he first heard about Ryan Speedo Green.
The long version goes back to my daughter, who was applying and then just getting into conservatories as an opera singer. She's long since decided it's way too narrow a target and taken another path. But I loved to dispense my wisdom about her singing when she was 18. And I figured once she got into conservatory, I better learn a little more fast if I was going to continue to dispense wisdom. So I went to my editors at the New York Times Magazine and said, you know, there's this annual contest that the Metropolitan Opera holds to find the most promising singers, young by opera standards, so up to the age of 30. They knew nothing about it. They said, great. I went off and started with the district rounds all over the country, and it came time for the semifinals. And here's what happened. So I got the list of the semifinals from the Met. There were 22 of them. I wrote to them by email. I said, write to me about anything, your relationship to music, your life, whatever you want. And everyone wrote back, some at great length, thinking, yeah, chance at the cover of the New York Times Magazine, I'm gonna grab this. Every single one of them wrote back except Ryan Speedo Green. Not a word from him. When I was hovering around the Met, waiting for the semifinals, nothing. Ryan Speedo Green made himself very scarce. I didn't think anything of it because the insiders at the Met were not saying, hey, you should keep an eye on Ryan Speedo Green. He might win. He might actually have a career. And so I just proceeded. And then I heard his voice in a rehearsal, heard how rich it was. Didn't matter how raw it was, there was certainly something magical there, and then began to hear just a little bit of his story. As he tells it, I finally persuaded him to have a lunch that he agreed to for 45 minutes in the Met cafeteria, and that turned into 3 hours, and that turned into years. That was back in 2011.
And when you're doing that, so you're making friends with somebody, basically. Making a new friend, sort of.
It's interesting you phrase it that way. It's a very intense kind of intimacy. I wouldn't actually call it a friendship. It's something both more than that and less than that. I'm not equally confiding in him. And so it's not exactly a friendship, but it's an intense level of trust that's building up over time, where he's entrusting his story to me, and I hope I am rising to the level of the trust he's placing in me, both in terms of his confidence, but then also in terms of my job of finding the language and finding the sort of structure of narrative to really do justice to what he's laying before me.
And how can you let him know that you're going to do that? Because you get people to tell you some stuff, Daniel Bergner. How do you get people to tell you this stuff?
You know, first of all, I can't guarantee that I'm going to do that because each book is an incredible challenge, right? So how do I win that trust? I think partly it's just being deeply, genuinely interested in listening and understanding. It's being willing to ask the same questions over and over again and listen again and empathize and imagine and then come back and ask yet again to make sure. And even though on the one hand that could seem relentless and sort of burdensome, on the other, it's an attempt to really go deep. And I think for the most part, we all long for that. There's no trick here. It's like we all want to be understood. So it's almost as simple as that. And you know, if the connection's right, and of course I feel like I'm writing about things that have obsessed me forever, so the interest really, you know, has a deep foundation for me, and I think that other person, in this case Ryan, is really responding to that.
And then you're not afraid to say, in fact you openly say, when you don't understand something, or that you're in a position not to understand.
I'd say I, more than that, openly acknowledge that, you know, whether, you know, it wasn't, by the way, quite women's orgasms. It was women and desire. But whether it's a subject as where there's a clear subjective divide, or whether it's a, or with Ryan, like, you know, black, white, totally different upbringings, even on a superficial level, 6'5", and, you know, what he sees as tiny, 5'10¾". You know, we're crossing a kind of a divide, a chasm, and I feel like it's important to acknowledge that. It's not a reason not to do these works of narrative journalism. In fact, there's every reason to do them because of the divide, but you kind of have to start from fully acknowledging that distance and confiding that awareness of distance in the person, and that thereby freeing them to sort of bring you closer and bring the reader closer. I guess that's what I hope that creates, a kind of intimacy for the reader as well.
Because I think, you know, people talk about, write about what you know, but you specifically seek what you want to know, it seems to me.
Yes, but.
But.
I think there's, yeah, it's writing about what you want to know, but there's also an identification. And you know, in the Ryan story, it really goes back. You know, I rarely talk about this, but so in some ways I've been writing about race since high school. I had this really, really close friendship with a black kid who, I was in Seattle at the time, and they had a very small busing program. This was way, way back. And rather than have the riots that were going on in Boston, they decided to have this small voluntary busing program, and this kid who I became very close with was part of that. We became inseparable. And then that friendship ended in a pretty tumultuous way, and I ended up writing my college application essay about that. So in some way, like, this is not foreign. This is really, really close. And I'd say in different ways we could go into it. Even the prison book, I felt this affinity. So yeah, it's crossing distances, but always with me having this attachment underlying the distance.
But when you can find yourself talking about some really sticky things, you know, really complicated issues that a lot of people might kind of shy away from, what is it in you that makes you seek out that conversation? Was it in your family? Were you raised in a family of very open talkers? How did that happen?
You really want me on the couch here. And I'm ready, so just, you know, we can pretend the rug is a couch. I don't know. It's like this desire. It's, you know, if any of you know, E.M. Forster can go back, you know, ways to when he read Passage to India way back in college, maybe. I mean, you know, he talks about only connect. That's the phrase. Like, that's sort of his mission, and I guess I share that. It's this wish to connect, and it's when it's happening, whether it's in conversation or whether it's then later, you know, at my desk alone, but finding the words to create that connection that brings me back to the person and then forward to the reader, I don't know, there's something magical in that to me. There's something hypnotic to me. It's a release, and it's spiritual. It's a fully, I'd say, when it's going really, really well, I'd say it's a fully It's a kind of religious experience.
Well, now that takes me to a completely different place, interestingly, because we'll talk about in the land of magic soldiers for a minute there.
Okay.
In magical experience, because you were talking about Father Chema. Yeah. And I think this is a perfect time to kind of talk about that, because he was a priest who saw all kinds of awful things and he heard heartbreaking confessions, but he still was this incredibly loving person. And how did that, is that what spoke to you so much? I mean, I know you mentioned that that was very, critical to you.
Right, so we better give a bit of background.
Yeah, sorry, jumping forward. But
second nonfiction book I did, I went to Sierra Leone as it was still sort of finding its way out of, at the tail end of, a very, very brutal civil war. And in fact, somewhere out there, Mary Kortenhoven, hello. I began following one of the family I began following was from Grand Rapids, and a missionary family who traveled from Grand Rapids with their young children to a tiny village in the middle of Sierra Leone to do good work there, to bring clean water, to bring a bit of education, to bring a bit of promise to a very, very difficult place. Their story is one of the things that utterly captivated me and that I ended up writing about in The Land of Magic Soldiers. Another, as you say, was this priest, Father Chema, who worked with child soldiers, and this is gonna take us to a pretty dark place pretty fast, however necessary. So sort of the signature atrocity of the war was that really multiple sides would amputate limbs and then leave that person to live as a kind of as a effort at just the most pure, raw kind of intimidation. And Father Chema worked with kids who'd done this, and he had this small camp by the sea full of these young teenagers. And he also had, he was very alone, he was a Spanish priest working by himself there. And he also had by his bed this small, broken crucifix. Now, you gotta realize, I'm Jewish. This was not like, I didn't go to seek out, you know, my lost Catholic self. But I immediately found this tremendous spiritual profundity. I can't capture to you, I hope the words do in the book, the beauty of this crucifix, and that it was broken, of course, was very emblematic given the atrocity that he was dealing with. And I guess the level of sort of gentleness and of ability to go deep with these kids. I don't know, again, it was one of these stories I just could not walk away from. It was magical, and it was a reminder of what we're capable of as human beings. And sometimes I guess you have to go really far out there. I was pretty far from home to really find those stories in such a distilled form that can remind us of who we are.
And yet you find then, again, spiritual profundity, that Ryan, for instance, you describe him as a radiant human being, but he certainly had a difficult road to get there.
Incredibly difficult. So Ryan grew up in southeastern Virginia and grew up in low-income housing and in a trailer park, and then when his mom could no longer afford the payments there, he grew up in basically a shack that was across the street from this drug dealer's headquarters, and there was a ton of drug traffic on his street. He was harassed by the dealers. Along the way, too, he had a very volatile relationship with his mom, a very violent one in both directions. His mom was angry at her two sons for she felt ruining her life. And at 12, he threatened her life, threatened the life of his brother, and was taken away, not only in cuffs, but in leg shackles, put in the back of a police car, driven all the way across the state, locked up, and was so angry there and was lashed out so often and so violently at staff and other residents that he was put in the seclusion cells there. And again, important to emphasize, this is a 12-year-old kid. And I can still remember when he and I went back to visit a bunch of times, and he and I went back to visit once, and the geography of the place came back to him immediately. He went right to the seclusion cell and sort of touched the walls as if trying to sort of, I don't know, reconcile himself with who he had been. And yeah, a lot of this book was an attempt, I think, on both of our parts to figure out how that transformation could take place. How do you get from there to this radiant human being that Ryan is, and, you know, as you've seen, this enormously talented singer that he is?
Well, experiencing as much trauma as he did. I mean, Sing for Your Life is an intentional title. Can you talk about how he came to be the singer that he is a little bit, and how that seemed to really kind of save him?
Right. So we better talk about two teachers.
Yes.
And Ryan would really feel I'd been remiss if I didn't, because he credits inspiring educators with his transformation. He doesn't give himself enough credit for sheer will. We'll talk about that. But okay, teacher number one was actually before he got locked up, so it's not like she snapped her fingers and changed Ryan's life. But so as a 9 to 11-year-old, he was relegated to this classroom that held the 6 or 7 most uncontrollable elementary schoolers in his entire school district. No one knew what to do with them. They sent them to Mrs. Hughes. Mrs. Hughes, 5'1", white, big piled up curls of blonde hair, met up with Ryan, and his first day in her class, he threw his desk at her, told her he wasn't gonna learn from any white lady, and expected to be kicked out, because that's what had always happened in the past. And not only that, but sometimes everyone else in the classroom had been cleared out for safety's sake. Ryan had been left alone in the classroom at times till he could be carted away. So he expected something like that. Instead, she looked back at him, looked down at the desk, and said, well, your desk's on the floor. You can learn from the floor. And when you're ready to learn in the normal way, you can have your desk back, and we'll, you know, write that and give you back your chair, and you can learn from a desk and a chair. And he kind of remembers sort of thinking, oh, like, this is going to be different. And difference number two was that she was very aware of this racial distance between her and her students, and taught them, had them memorize a large section of the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech for many reasons. One was to bridge the racial gap between them. Another was to teach them something about transcending race. But a third was really, you know, she was a woman who felt that the past simply could not matter. She refused to listen to other teachers who of course, were eager to tell her all the trials and tribulations they'd had with her particular students. Oh, you've got so-and-so. Oh, my gosh, that's going to be just awful. I hope you survive. She would all but literally put her hands over her ears and wanted these kids to know this was about the content of their character, and they could shape their own character. And to Ryan, that remained a touchstone. Like I said, he was locked up thereafter. It wasn't a transformative, completely transformative episode in his life, but that I Have a Dream speech then comes back to him repeatedly. So to flash forward now a few years from after he got locked up, he kind of lucked his way into this half-day School of the Arts program. He was playing football. He had to take choir as an easy credit so he could spend more time playing football. He's 6'5", you kind of can tell. He's 6'5" now and 320, but he was big as a kid. And then he got into his head, and I've never been able to sort out if this is really true, that in order to get that choir credit, he had to at least audition for this School of the Arts. And anyway, he auditions. He sings the Star Spangled Banner, and he memorizes this tiny blip of an Italian art song, and he doesn't know how to sing with the piano. They have to, like, figure out how to get him to sing, not a cappella. Anyway, he does this, not particularly auspiciously, but by that point, Mrs. Hughes' husband, who's an administrator in the school system, has become the head of this arts program, puts his fingers on the scales, and Ryan gets in, and is about to get tossed out after a year. He doesn't read music. He's not really all that talented, and this is something we need to go into because no one ever believes that. And but he sticks it out. He falls under the spell of an African-American teacher there who kind of takes him under wing, at least just to get him through. And that teacher takes Ryan and his classmates on a trip from southeastern Virginia to the Met. And they see Carmen. And starring in Carmen that night is an African-American mezzo-soprano named Denise Graves. She has a gorgeous voice, and she is gorgeous. And Ryan falls in love on all levels. And lo and behold, Mr. Brown, it turns out, Mr. Brown's the voice teacher, knows Denise Graves from the DC area, takes the kids backstage. Denise Graves kind of focuses, zeroes in on Ryan, gives him a hug, calls him as he likes to remember her boo, and he walks out onto the Met Plaza. You can picture that plaza, the fountains fountaining, and says to Mr. Brown, I'm going to sing at the Met someday. And Mr. Brown looks back at him, and you know, at this point, he still really can't read music, and says, you got a long list of things. But, you know, 9 years later, there he was in this contest.
So you said he was not really all that talented. I still have a hard time believing you. How did he find the voice? How did they find it?
I know, no one ever believes me, nor did my editor when I turned in my first draft. It was the only thing she asked me to go back and re-ask people about. And I went back to the head of the vocal department who remembers Brian well, and he said no, he just didn't have a special voice. He could carry a tune. But it was not this voice. First of all, it was a tenor voice. I mean, his voice hadn't really changed. It was a voice that was all over the place. He just didn't have the tools. How did it change? Because this very special teacher, Mr. Brown, not only took Ryan under wing, bought him clothes, taught him to drive, intervened with his mom when necessary, but increment by increment began to teach him how to build and control this voice, which we still didn't know was, you know, really, like, again, hard to believe, but when I first started proposing that I stick around at Ryan's shoulder as the Met took him on as a trainee after the contest, people were pretty uncertain whether that was a good idea, and certainly uncertain that all would end so wonderfully. This wasn't necessarily going to happen at all.
Well, regardless of whether or not he won, why did they think it was not a good idea to follow Ryan around?
Might be too much pressure. Would sort of construct expectations that might not be met. So, you know, there was a winning people over process on that side. What I saw was just no matter how this turns out, you know, Ryan just won this contest. And this is a wonderful story, even if he winds up in the Met chorus. And for that matter, there were all these other aspects to it. I mean, you know, he didn't know his father growing up, and he managed on the eve of the semifinals to reach his father across the country in Bakersfield, California, to explain to his father, you know, what he was doing, what he was singing, that this was a really big deal. And his father said, if you make it to the finals, I'll get myself across the country. Ryan did not really expect to make it, and he didn't even bring a tuxedo to New York. He knew the finals were a formal concert in front of a packed house at the Met, but he didn't even bring his tuxedo because he didn't really expect to make it. But he really, there was a lot of longing informing his performance in the semifinals because he really wanted to get his father there.
Well, and reading the coachings, and when you write about the coachings, it feels very uncertain when you're listening to the conductors talking to him about how they feel about him.
Right. So there's this one moment. Maybe I should just
sure. Let's
read
let's talk
tiny,
about this one
tiny
moment.
Bit. So, you know, Opera's a pretty exacting world. I'm going to have to dig up
here,
my
glasses.
Here, let
me glasses. Find it for you. Hold on a second. While you find your glasses, I'll
so
find
the page.
So it's a
really, really exacting art form. And, you know, I think most people here know this, but it's one that combines tremendous nuance and beauty with really sort of off the charts power, because there's no amplification in opera. It's one thing to fill a room like this. It's another at the Met where, you know, 4,000 people. This is basically, roughly speaking, about twice the size of even the most prestigious opera halls in Europe. So it's very unusually large. And so all that power has to happen combined with all that beauty, plus the lower your voice, the harder it is for your voice to carry over an orchestra. That has to do with kind of the sound waves. We could get into the science here. And so to really learn to have that reach combined with the magic and the nuance is very tough. So here is a moment. After he got through the semifinals, he starts to get this intense week of training at the Met. There was this very, I don't want to say finicky, because he was really devoted to his art, conductor, who began to coach Ryan one day. His name was Patrick Summers. And he was trying to coach him in Italian, getting really, really frustrated. Ryan's Italian was abysmal in his ears. And Ryan was starting to sweat, and literally sweat, and just totally discombobulated. And it was really, really painful to be sitting there. And then Patrick Summers suggests that Ryan try something in English. So here's just a tiny bit of that scene. We're coming out of the Italian, as Summers says, you must work on that word. And it's really that particular. They would spend half an hour on a single word. You must work on that word. Multiple rivulets of sweat forked around Ryan's temples. Let's try the Floyd, the conductor named an English language piece from Ryan's list. Ryan sang it through. Do you even like this aria? Ryan did. He loved it. Not really, he said. Ryan couldn't bear to acknowledge his attachment to the piece and hear Summers tell him every way that he'd ruined it. So I guess that's just a tiny example of, you know, what Ryan continued to have to go through. Mm-hmm. This journey, you know, the journey of obstacles didn't end after high school, didn't end after college. It continued right on through to the Met. And one of the things that was so impressive to me, and I think came from all he'd been through as a kid, is that he had the strength to just endure moment after moment like that. Equally impressive, he sort of refused to try to fake his way through anything. So I remember one moment where a coach was saying to him, you know, this should be imbued with melancholy. And Ryan said, I'm not sure what melancholy means. And, you know, that took an incredible bravery. But he had resolved to himself, given the opportunity, he was not going to waste anything. And if that meant exposing what he did not know, he was going to expose it. And, you know, the end result is what you've heard.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Kate Botello's conversation with Daniel Bergner.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlaken Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Kate Botello's conversation with Daniel Bergner.
Well, I think abused children, for instance, you said it specifically. His mother said she ruined his life. And here, he didn't want to hear that he'd ruined something else. Somewhere in there's always that fear that he's a ruiner, you know, and that's hard to read. How do you write a scene like that?
So the first book I published was a novel, and I think I'm always trying to get that level of intimacy and that level of scenic detail into my nonfiction, because I want you to be relating to the character with that intense closeness that you have when you're reading a character in a novel that you love. So my task is either to be there and thus to be able to describe it and, you know, to be able to hone it down to the essential details of a scene, or to ask and ask and ask so that I can recreate. So for instance, going back to the time in the facility, I kind of lucked into finding there was still a 500 page logbook of Ryan's time there that in many cases chronicled him every 15 minutes. And so that was just a tremendous resource in trying to recreate that. If it's the painful scenes or the scenes of triumph, and there are many here, yeah, my job is to give you that sense of being inside the scene.
And is it, it seems so much a matter of a very careful word choice here and there, a very careful adjective. Do you just throw all of them at the screen and see which one gives you the best feeling or the one that you're going for? How do you do that?
I wish I had that kind of sensibility where I was like so free and easy that I would just throw things at the screen and then I could call back later. No, I think I spend an absurd amount of time like picking apart words, and then I hope that no one notices that that's been the process. I mean, the process of reading it should be that it hurtles along, but the process of writing it has absolutely nothing to do with speed and is quite sluggish.
Well, yeah. I can imagine. Actually, let's talk about that for a minute, too. Just the process of writing all of these books. I had a friend specifically say, please ask him how he does that. Because you're writing very intense stuff. Is it solitary for you? What are your rituals when you write? Because everybody has their own, I'm sure.
Well, the first ritual, of course, is about being there and asking and listening. And then, I guess when that's mostly over, although there'll be a last round of it, usually. Of course, it's solitary. It's often, you know, over 1,000 pages of transcript. It's sitting with that. And I don't know, it's finally an act of faith, right? You're believing that there's a story here that if you chisel away at all the extraneous stuff, you'll wind up with something that does justice to this person who's entrusted his life to you, right? And I think this is the tricky thing. Sometimes I talk to students who, like, it's easy for them to understand that I need to be faithful to what that person has said, and it's a whole nother, which I do, and then there's a whole nother leap to I need to actually shape, and that can seem like it's somehow a deception or that I'm, but it's not. It's the necessary thing that allows that person's story to reach the readers in a way that's, I hope, gripping.
Now, you mentioned the transcriptions, that you sit with the transcriptions. You do one thing that's very unusual, I think it is anyway, which is that you take down, you do your own transcribing. And why do you do that?
So probably for me and my writer friends, as we've grown up together, it wasn't unusual when we were young. Now, most of them just pay someone else to do it. Why do I absurdly not do that? Because it's just a way to be back inside that person's voice. And it's actually incredibly soporific, so it requires a nap for each session. And I swear that's not an indulgence on my part. I just leap over to my bed about 5 minutes in because it's just like that. There's something about the experience. It's sort of ultimately very passive to sit there. Absolutely necessary. So I have to crawl out of bed and go back to it each time.
And it's surprising to me with some of the things that you have to listen to in your transcriptions that you can sleep afterwards. So let me ask you this. You've been through all of these intense places with incredibly intense people, and they tell you these stories. How is it to be receiving those stories? How do you internally handle receiving so many really intense stories.
So with the exception of this book, which is definitely not in any way depressing, I often get, you know, asked how I deal with these depressing subjects. And all I can say is that I'm warped enough not to experience them exactly as depressing. What I'm experiencing deep sadness, but I'm also experiencing deep beauty, and then trying to write in a way that's beautiful enough to mirror the beauty that I felt. And I felt that in Sierra Leone. Father Chaim is a good example. Mary Kortenhoven with those flowers in the middle of the Sierra Leonean jungle is another. Another, you know, well, let's stay with Ryan for a sec. Yeah. Let's not forget his voice, right? That, I mean, the challenge of finding the language to capture that voice was really, really engaging. So no matter how dark things got, there was this other side. And there was this, there's also, just to go back to his coaches for a sec, yes, they were exacting and terrifying, but they were also inhabiting this totally unexpected world. So the Met, front side of the Met, tremendous glamour, you know, crimson carpets and wonderful chandeliers. The backside and the underside of the Met, totally the reverse. So if you go down to the coaching studios, you know, they're crypt-like and they're unreclaimed and they leak and there are no windows and, you know, the headroom, I can't even clear my head. Ryan had to turn practically perpendicular to go under these tunnels to get there. And you get there and you're with the greatest coaches in the world. One of Ryan's coaches had been a prodigy pianist, had played at the White House with Itzhak Perlman, but he decided, no, his calling was to coach the voice, coach it at the Met. So one of these coaches, I so vividly remember, always carried with him. He was even more monastic than the rest, really pallid and never combed his hair, barely saw sunlight. I mean that quite literally. But he carried with him this, by now, kind of dingy, laminated picture of what's inside of all of our heads and right behind all of our faces. And because to him, it was this glorious amphitheater that we'd all been given and that sort of serves as an emblem of the potential we all have, perhaps not Ryan's potential, but to create beautiful sound. And he would bring this out to his nephews, he brought out to Ryan and me and just say, isn't this glorious? He could not get enough of it. And indeed, it was glorious to look at what's in here, these curves and these pockets of resonance that singers work with to make this powerful sound that comes up from our lungs and through these rather crude, you know, straps, really, that is our vocal cords. There's barely a difference between mine and Ryan's. And then, but here's all the differences here and here and here, and how he uses those things to turn this crude propulsion of air into that very gorgeous, complex sound that can go really reach right inside us.
But the sound, the description of how to make that sound, it's so esoteric. It's so, you have to be able to just kind of be creative and use your imagination and just deal with it because it's so inexact. I mean, there were ping pong balls, the air behind your eyes. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah,
it's so strange.
I mean, it kind of would bring us back to Sierra Leone because there's definitely a shamanistic element to some of this. Like, we're talking about the involuntary or largely involuntary places within our heads and behind our faces. So the easiest example is our soft palates, the back of the roof of our mouths. And that is not an area that's easily controlled. Many would call that an involuntary part of our anatomy. And yet, it has to be controlled. And the elevation of it, and we're talking about, you know, micromillimeters, or the angle of it, deeply affects the sound that then comes out. And so some singers do imagine not just a ping pong ball above their head, but a fountain keeping that ping pong ball aloft. And through this metaphor, somehow, you can hear a difference. I don't know how to explain it. It is kind of magic. You know, Ryan being a football fan and his very accomplished once met Star, having once been a high school quarterback, actually, they would talk about Superdome, you know, the New Orleans football stadium, just think Superdome, and somehow thinking about dome, elevate the soft palate, and out comes Ryan's sound. I don't know how to explain it. We don't know how to explain it.
I don't know if anybody really does. That's the thing. It seems to be so vague.
Well, maybe less but vague than purely metaphoric. Yeah. And no, I mean, I would really, I mean, the reporter in me was like, okay, I'm going to talk to this ENT who knows the field and talk to that, you know, physiologist. And no, nobody has a real explanation for how this happens, but it does happen.
But then you also talked about the difference in the colors. So this does happen. So if you lift the imaginary soft palate with the ping pong balls or whatever it is you need, this creates different, what we call, colors. Now, did you learn about those from the Met coaches? Were you hearing them yourself? Was there that moment when you thought, aha, that's what they mean?
Well, so again, maybe important to note, where, you know, once we get into colors and texture and whether the voice is more like a trumpet or like a trombone and the mixture that you have to create to sing great operatic arias, important to note where we started this story, locked up in Virginia's Juvenile Institution of Last Resort. But yes, that's the journey. And did I hear them when I started out? Definitely not. Could I hear them somewhat by the end? Yes, because I made a conscious decision that even if I wasn't going to end up knowing everything about sort of the catalog of operas, I was going to try to know everything about the manufacture of beauty. And so I had these amazing teachers, just like Ryan had the best teachers in the world. I went up with the best teachers in the world. And yeah, I mean, I would sit in these Juilliard rooms that's across the street from the Met with these fabulous coaches who would sit at the piano and, you know, help me to hear so that I could understand what Ryan was doing. And then, you know, without belaboring it, find a language that was gripping that could take a reader toward that sound.
And an especially big challenge there, too, is as that sound is coming and the colors are coming out, he's a bass. So he's got a while before his voice is going to mature all the way.
Right. So
that's
two
tricky.
Things come to mind that are worth talking about. One, the second will bring us back to the subject of race. But first, the stakes involved. So there were all kinds of reasons I couldn't walk away from this story. But one was that particularly for a low-voiced man, and then for certain kinds of sopranos, big, big-voiced sopranos, full potential is unknown until, I mean, in Ryan's case, until his mid-40s. So this is tremendous success that he's got a major role in La Boheme. But for him to really succeed as a bass or a bass baritone, you know, he wants to be singing the epic roles of Wagner. And no one will know whether he has what it takes to do that until he's in his 40s. So this is a lifelong level of devotion with success unknown until really it's too late to turn back. And that seems so charged to me and so poetic that, again, it was an element that I didn't want to walk away from in the story. The other thing maybe we should get into, now that you mentioned his being a bass, is, so, you know, once Ryan caught this love of opera, he had to deal with all kinds of pressures. He went to this half-day school for the arts, but the other half of his day was spent in his regular high school, or riding the bus to his regular high school in particular, and there, you know, scores were slapped out of his hand. Why are you singing white music? We always knew you wanted to be white. Well, Ryan doesn't want to be white. I can assure you, Ryan is fiercely African-American, but you can imagine what that's like for a high school kid. And then on the other side, there are all kinds of preconceptions that sort of stand in the way of an African-American singer. For Ryan, there's also something more, and there's that literally since high school, every time he's sung in an opera or sung a recital, Liszt, Mahler, people come up to him, white people, and say, oh, you remind me so much of Paul Robeson. you know, you should really sing Old Man River. And, you know, again and again and again. Once in college, he was at this very small scale summer festival in Cape Cod. And he actually was cast as Joe in Old Man River. And for those of you who don't know, so Joe is all but a slave on a steamboat, Jim Crow South, laboring, sweating, below decks, paid very little, and feels so confined by his life that he looks to the Mississippi and to death as his only chance of release. And he sings a song in dialect, in a very heavy black dialect about this. So Ryan sings this song, and he gets a standing ovation there in Cape Cod. Not only does he get a standing ovation, the standing ovation will not end until he has halted the show and repeated the song. And then time after time, college, at the Met, you should really sing Old Man River. You should really sing Old Man River. That's, I can hear you. You're the embodiment of Joe. And to him, of course, he knows Old Man River is a beautiful piece of music, but to him, it's like putting him back inside a box. And Ryan's entire life since high school has been about sort of expanding the ideas of identity when it comes to race. And here are people saying, no, go back inside that box, or so it feels to him. And he's finally asked to sing this at a kind of Met patron event, and he all but breaks down because it's so anathema to really what he's all about. That was one of the most painful moments of following him on his journey. It's just a song, but it's not just a song. And just to cut right to it, he said to me once, you know, there's no way that an audience of African Americans would give me a standing ovation so long that they'd want to hear that and say they want to sing that, hear mm-hmm. me sing that song again. That, what he really asked me, he's like, what is it about you white people that makes you want to hear me inhabit Joe? Like, I'm not Joe. And so, yes, it is funny, and it's also, in, I think, very telling and very much about our times. Like, he wasn't talking mm-hmm. about people who didn't have liberal sensibilities. He wasn't, you know, the Met is about as liberal as it gets in terms of a world, but he was just talking about the complexity of identity in a way that I found really telling and that I wanted to tell.
Yeah, I think he mentioned there that it let the white audiences feel good about feeling bad.
Yeah,
you know, he felt it was kind of a self-congratulatory, you know, look, we're upset by this, good for us,
yeah,
kind of thing. And he specifically says in the book that, you know, despite all the colors and all the wonderful things and the big voice and all of this stuff, just because he's black, he has to be that much better. So he can't just get by being good. Because he's black, and he says it himself, he has to go even further.
Right, and that is true. He does say that, and so does this other, for opera fans out there, another of the very few African-American singers who've really made it out there, Eric Owens, who I spent a little bit of time with. Both said the same thing, but both also said, and this is important to add, because, you know, Ryan is very candid about the obstacles presented him because of race, but he's also very demanding about what he needs to do, as is Eric Owens. Like, and Eric would say to me, you know, thinking about the distortions of how a caster is going to hear because I'm black is all well and good and true. But nevertheless, if I go in there thinking about that and excusing myself on those grounds, then I'm just not going to sing the way I need to sing. And I need to sing color right out of that casting director's mind. That is my job. I am going to walk in there and just obliterate race for that moment. I'm going to obliterate the visual with the oral, A-U-R-A-L. And Ryan would say the same thing. And again, such a just gripping mission to want to sing your way past race.
And very, very difficult to do, and maybe never passed. You know, it's, I think it's, you know, it's probably often going to just stay there. I mean, it doesn't go away. It doesn't disappear. Maybe now would be the time for us to do a little bit of more reading of, this is, again, sticky stuff. You are not afraid to write about sticky stuff or to ask people about it. And this is Ryan being very particular. Hold on a second. Let me pull this out for you.
So maybe I should read all of this, because, or at least some chunk of it, because it really does get to the complexity of Ryan's thought. So he said to me once, being African-American is so convoluted. It's 250 years of slavery, 250 years of endless days, endless servitude. No race since the Jews in the Bible can attest to that longevity of persecution. It was being 3/5 of a human being. And then it was being recognized as 100% of a human being. And still, for another 100 years, no, for longer than that, having to prove yourself to be human, to be equal, mentally, physically, socially equal. Even though you picked their crops, even though you built their houses, even though you built this country, being African American is overcoming. It's willpower. Every other race came here by choice, starting with the Native Americans walking across from Asia. We are the only race who didn't. I was put here. My forebears were brought here in the galleys of ships. There is nothing prouder to me than being African American. There's no race more special in the United States. We persevered. With everything I do, every success that I'm hoping for, there's some spirit out there, the spirit of a person in rags who dreamt of being able to read a book or go to a movie or run for office. Being African American is the greatest gift God could have given me.
That's just, I can take that in for a second. I mean, he's saying it's something to overcome, which is hard to hear, and yet if we say that's not true, we're negating someone else's experience. We can't do that. We have to let him say what he believes to be true and what is true for him. And then to say that it's a gift, I think is just incredible. And that shows more of who he is. I mean, you talk about what an incredible person Ryan is.
You know? Yeah, I think, you know, people are often surprised, or even, you know, when they hear him now on the radio in interviews, just with how complex and how deep his thinking is. You know, this is a singer and then some. And you know, maybe this ties back into the Martin Luther King speech in a way. You know, being able to declare that dream on the Met's plaza, on the Lincoln Center plaza, being able to talk like this goes back, I think, in a way to Mrs. Hughes and learning that speech. And I think in a way it was a real challenge to me. I thought a lot, I read a lot about civil rights history and about, I don't know if a lot of you are aware of this, but you know, King broadened out his vision in the last couple of years of his life to one that was much more, as he put it, about human rights than just about civil rights or about race. And it was this idea that really we could transcend race, and of course we had that momentary illusion in 2008 that we were on that path. But King was really criticized for this. I mean, King was considered kind of passé. I mean, his last book was sort of dismissed as foolishness. A much more kind of militant and identity-based vision of racial progress had taken hold by the sort of mid-ish late 60s. And King was kind of humiliated by other civil rights leaders toward the end of his life. And I kept thinking back to that with Ryan and with Ryan's mission, which brought me back to that idea of, you know, can we transcend? Can we break those boundaries, break those lines? Of course, I don't know the answer. We're a long way from it. You know, I thought myself about my place within this as, you know, as a white writer writing about a black man's life. But part of me, Ryan really made me hopeful. He's like listening to Ryan, hearing Ryan's voice is definitely a note of hope.
It's amazing how much light he can find in all of that, and that he does always acknowledge how much the love of the teachers and the help of the teachers and the lifting of the music and all of those things, what they mean to him. But, you know, he's very exacting toward himself and for other African Americans as well. I mean, he's very firm about that in saying things that, you know, a white, that you couldn't say, perhaps, or at all, really. I mean, let's be honest about that. He can be critical in ways that you cannot.
Yeah, and Ryan is critical. I mean, he now lives, I should say, mostly in Vienna, Austria, which is one of the top five opera houses in Europe. They've hired him to do a series of important roles. And looking back at what our country is going through in terms of race really horrifies him from a distance. At the same time, he's pretty critical about, you know, some of rap music's messages, particularly about the parts of what he sees as, you know, African-American culture's failure to hold itself to the standards that he wishes it did. So there's just so much that goes on in Ryan's thinking, and even sometimes I'll sit with him at dinner now, and it's even extended past where we got in the book. He's just great company, really. I mean, that's what it comes down to.
What do you think that Ryan would like us to see when we read this book? What do you think he'd like for us to take away?
You're letting me speak as Ryan.
Or from what?
No. I mean, it's a good, no, it is a good question. I think one of the things he would like would be to go back to those educators and just say, you know, this mattered so much. Don't give up faith. You know, whatever your chance is to see someone in a new way, to see beneath what he would call the covers of the book, which in his case weren't very pretty covers, take that chance. I mean, it's funny, my son's just started teaching in a pretty rough school, and he's only 22, and he's teaching seniors, and it's, you know, a pretty chaotic picture, I think, at times. And he tells himself periodically, you know, I just have to be more like Mrs. Hughes. I just have to be more like Mrs. Hughes. And I think that would be a lesson that Ryan would want us to take away.
Everybody, be more like Mrs. Hughes. Okay. That's important. Thank you, Daniel Bergner. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thanks, Kate.
That was Daniel Bergner talking with Kate Botello. Daniel Bergner's latest book is Sing for Your Life. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melcarrick.